VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away. All with our award-winning commentary, opinion, and insights. Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and The Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the game. We are live from Newcastle. I am Alison Rudd. I'm hosting an evening of lively, informed football debate. And we're in front of a passionate and knowledgeable, one of the most knowledgeable group of supporters in the country, so no pressure on you guys at all. This evening we're going to be discussing life at St James's Park. If you're a Newcastle fan and you're sending an email, are you signing it off with a smiley face or a frowny face? Is the club in a period of calm, or is it the calm before yet another storm? We'll be examining state of play at the other clubs in the northeast, and we'll be delving into England and Roy Hodgson's valiant attempts to make sure any optimism we felt about the World Cup is dampened. To discuss and navigate through these weighty topics, I have a fantastic panel. The Times chief football correspondent is Oliver Kay on my right. On my far left is our man in the northeast, George Colkin, and our special guest is Steve Harper, who, after 20 loyal years at Newcastle, is one of their most beloved players. He now plays, of course, at Hull City, and I have it on good authority that his signing at that club swung Hull being named as City of Culture this morning.
4 months, so you have turned the place round.
So we're going to start with, where else, Newcastle United. I understand there's going to be a plaque unveiled at St James's Park, and it's going to say, this is the birthplace of the tactic that so ruffles Jose Mourinho. So makes it sound like it's going well. You know, Alan Pardew tactically outwitted Chelsea. They beat Spurs, but there were losses to Hull, losses to Sunderland. So where are we in this strange state of flux? Is it good news or bad news at the club? And I'm going to start with our man in the northeast, George.
Thank you very much. It's been a deeply unpredictable start to the season. It's difficult to predict anything at Newcastle, as you all know. There were worrying signs, I thought, obviously in the summer, not signing a player permanently, and obviously the Sunderland game was a sort of big disappointment. I think just at the point where we were predicting or expecting Newcastle to lurch into crisis, they then brought it round with those two very fine victories over Chelsea and then over Spurs. You know, the way Newcastle is set up at the minute, it always feels like it's crisis postponed, delayed. It's just around the corner. Two or three defeats in a row can do that. And there's also the way the club is set up at the minute. You know, to describe the relationships at Newcastle as delicate, as tortuous, as bizarre, is an understatement. One thing I would say is that there's a very good first 11 at Newcastle, really good, and one that is certainly worthy of being where they are on the table. There's not enough depth, I think Alan Pardew's got some things very right in the last two or three weeks. His way he's handled Hatem Ben Arfa, for example, who's undoubtedly Newcastle's most talented player, but has been left out, and deservedly so, in my opinion, has been interesting. You know, there's reasons to be positive, but there's that big, big reason to be fearful, and that's Mike Ashley and what might happen next.
So are you saying it is impossible to separate tactics and personnel from the way the club is run in order to be able to say whether you feel optimism for the rest of the season or not?
I'm a naturally optimistic person, but I'm naturally pessimistic when it comes to Newcastle. I mean, I think that's kind of the only way to be, really. You know, I just think, however well things are going at Newcastle, there's a decision around the corner. You know, that's how I would term it. It's not necessarily a bad decision, but I think we've seen that this regime is incapable of stringing two good decisions together. I mean, that's what I would say. And, you know, after 2 years of sort of listening to, and because it was something that I kind of believed in, this whole idea of stability at Newcastle, putting down foundations and looking to build, you know, there's then a little bit of flux, and the answer to that is by bringing in Joe Kinnear, as if that's in any way going to encourage stability of any sort. So that's what I mean. I mean, you know, there are good people at Newcastle, some very good players. I'm pleased with where they are on the table. I'm certainly pleased with the last couple of results. I just wouldn't want to sort of, I wouldn't want to take it much further than that.
Can we just clarify, because I don't actually know, Remy, wasn't that Joe Kinnear's? Has that got anything to do with Joe Kinnear? Would that have happened if he didn't exist?
Trying to think how I can phrase this most politely. Thank you, Alison.
Depends who's in charge of the PR thing. Who's taking the credit?
The deal for Remy was sort of in place. The outline for that deal was in place before Joe Kinnear came to the club. That was the work of Derek Lambias. There were other similar things in place with Darren Bent, you know, obviously that didn't work out, and indeed Gomez. There were structures of deals, you know, in place. My understanding is that happened in spite of Joe Kinnear and not because of him, and I don't think he'd met him before the day he signed.
I'm glad we've clarified that.
He did meet other potential signings, and they didn't happen.
Okay, Steve. Steve, with the benefit of separation and stepping away and playing somewhere else, when you look at Newcastle, do you see it differently? When you're outside of the club, does it look like it's run differently, or is there more clarification for you?
I think you see it as a fan now, and as a fan, whenever you think there's a period of stability, having experienced 20 years of it, that's when you worry. Because it's almost, this is a little bit calm and a little bit sensible, as George said, what's going to happen next? Because it always has a habit of shooting itself in the foot, and I've often described it as a roller coaster, and it is, you know, as another thing I've described it as in the past, is it's a bipolar football club, and George touched on it himself there when things are going well. You know, it's all Champions League and we're heading in the right direction, and then you lose a couple of games and the doom and gloom sets in. And over my period of time there was never enough sort of middle ground where we're doing all right here. That's almost not acceptable as a Newcastle fan. And I mean, George touched on pretty much everything there, I think. The relationship between Alan Pardew and Joe Kinnear. I think if Joe Kinnear was brought in to be the manager, ultimately be the manager of Newcastle United, he would be by now. You know, I think he's quite happy doing the job he's doing. He's got the owner's ear. You know, whether he's confident or not, he's certainly taken the credit for the Remy signing, whether it was his or not. Whoever's it was, it's a very, very good one. So we'll have more of them, please. And at the moment, it's good, but you know, after a very disappointing Derby defeat, if they did then go on and lose to Chelsea and Tottenham, you just think what might have happened? Would there have been another change? Because by all accounts, what Alan Pardew said on goals on Sunday didn't go down very well with the people or the man upstairs, and he probably needed those results after the Derby game to keep his job, because you know what he did the previous year was fantastic, finishing fifth. But last year, as George said, the squad isn't big enough to cope with the Europa League, and this year there are no excuses. They have a very good 1-11, and I think if they don't finish in the top 10 of the Premier League, it'll cost Alan Pardew his job.
Ollie, where do you think Newcastle will finish this season?
Well, you look at their players, and it's as George has said, as Steve has said, it's a very good 11. You look at the bench, and it's, unless Hatem Banoff has been sat there on the naughty step, then it's not a strong bench, is it? It's not a deep squad that looks like it's been brilliantly invested in. And I think on a good day, as they've shown in the last few weeks, I think Newcastle can beat pretty much anyone. But on a bad day, they can lose to anyone. I mean, there are a lot of teams like that in this Premier League, but Newcastle seem to have a lot of... I'd be interested on Steve's perspective on this, but Newcastle seem to have a lot of moody players who go between being, you know, top class and being, you know, well, bottom of the class. It's people like, you know, Kabay, Tiote, Ben Arfa, their difference between two seasons ago and last season was just... It was night and day, it was chalk and cheese, and it's... That tells me that Newcastle are an extremely temperamental group of players and a temperamental team, and I think for as far as I can see, they are going to probably continue to sort of swing between one extreme and the other, because they are a moody bunch of players.
Is that a euphemism for foreign when you say temperamental? Well, just being a foreign?
No, well, to be honest, I think it's the type of foreign player they've got, and maybe I'm even going to be more specific and say it's French, because you look at what the French national team are like and have been like, and this current generation of French players, they seem to be very moody. They seem to turn it on and off the talent depending on their mood, and I'm talking about Tiote. He's not French, but he's French speaking.
He's
French speaking, but he is a player who I thought, looking at him 2 years ago, I thought God, he would improve any team in the Premier League. He would improve Man City, even though they were winning the league. He'd improve Man United, Arsenal certainly. And I looked at him last season, and it was just staggering, the difference. It was.
He didn't look like a footballer last season.
No, I always hate talking about body language, because it's quite deceptive in a lot of cases. But he just didn't look like, he didn't look interested. And I think a lot of, you know, Kabay and Ben Arfa and people like that, they probably came to Newcastle having had it sold to them almost as a stepping stone. And I think you could tell by last season. I think probably a lot of them wanted to go after the...
I think you touched on something that's important there, and it's not the foreign thing per se at all. What it is where Newcastle are in terms of their financial structuring. They have to look for value in the market now. By and large, they're not going to find it here. For kind of obvious reasons, so they've done very, very well in terms of the players they've brought in terms of talent, but they've had to invest in, I mean, I don't want to say wrong-uns, but they've had to invest in people who've got checkered character. There's a reason why some of these players are available for not too much money, and it's either baggage in terms of Ben Arfa. You know, I found it quite interesting at the start of this season, when Kabay effectively went on strike, when Arsenal were in for him, because that's how Newcastle got Ben Arfa, and that's how Newcastle got Sissoko when they did. So, it's an extremely delicate. I do feel sorry actually for Alan Pardew in this scenario, because as manager, he wants to improve. He wants to improve the team. Players want to be playing for a winning side. He has been selling promises to players that we will get better, we'll invest this summer, we'll do this and do that, and it hasn't happened. Now, if Newcastle are then struggling for motivation, it looks like it reflects on him. I'm sure some of the time it does, but I'm just saying, I think he's in a difficult position. They've got a team of sort of misfits in some ways. Mm.
Steve, listening to this, it sounds like a miracle they even... And they have put together some really almost quite stunning performances.
They have. I mean, being there at the end, obviously, you know, several players arrived in January, you know, be it French, foreign, whatever you want to call them. And it's a heavy shirt, a Newcastle United shirt. It's a tough place to play, and we've had players in the past good players who couldn't handle the crowd and it got a little bit too much for them, subsequently gone to other clubs and succeeded. And I think it took them a while to sort of get what it is in, about this club. And when you lose 6-0 at home to Liverpool and then lose 3-0 at home to Sunderland, it opens a few cracks, and it certainly did last year. And I think a few of them thought, hang on a second, what have I done? And when you've got pretty much 50% of your dressing room speaking French and a team is struggling, it does open a few.
How do you say to someone or a group of players who have no experience of what it's like to put on a Newcastle shirt and maybe don't quite get it, what can you say to them to prepare them for what it means and the subtle differences for playing for an averagely sized French club, for example?
Well, it's hard when I only know restaurant French, really. I struggle to put it in food terms. But we had interpreters there, and I mean, when you're playing in front of 52,000 and the fans are letting you know exactly what they think of you, I think it's pretty obvious that you need to do something about it. But it was at times uncomfortable last year. Like I said, when the team is struggling and you've got half your dressing room sitting together and talking, it can be difficult. But you know, fortunately we managed to get over the line, and I think what you've seen this year is they've started to get it a little bit more, and we've certainly seen the best of the likes of, you know, Debussy's really come to the fore, his form. Kabay's, you know, as George said, got over his little strop, and I think we're starting to see them bedding in. Maybe they've realised, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, Oliver mentioned it there, that Tioti looked a really top player, and I think last year maybe lost his identity a little bit, maybe started believing a few of the things the agents were saying in his ear, and he rather than just doing what it says on the tin, which is getting the ball back and giving it to the players that can play, he started to think he was a player himself and started appearing outside left and outside right.
Terrible error. Terrible error.
Just think, hang on a sec. I remember, you know, Colaccini one day in training actually stopped training and said, check, you know, what you're doing up there. Come back, get in here. This is what you do. Stick to doing that. And I think that's what he's doing now. You know, Graeme Souness used to say it was his job at Liverpool to get the ball back and give it to the players that can play. And I think that's now Cech's realised that's what he's good at. We're seeing the best of him again as well. But ultimately, I think the French players suddenly realise what Newcastle United is all about and what is expected of them, and we're seeing the benefits of that.
By the way, I just want to say very quickly, but that arguably Newcastle's best result this season may have been France's win last night. And the only reason I mean that is that you know, there haven't been new signings in the summer to push this squad along, but having the World Cup at the end of this season for, I think it's eight players at Newcastle have a realistic chance of getting there. I think that's massive. I think that's absolutely massive.
What you're saying is Newcastle could win the World Cup?
Well, they could get sent home in disgrace. Yes. I think that's more likely.
I have to say, when Newcastle beat Chelsea, I felt it was tangible that the Moody players had connected with the fans and connected with what it meant and connected with whatever Pardew was asking them to do. And I found that quite a refreshing sight. But I wonder, anyone in the room, maybe we, I don't know, does anyone want to say what they feel? Does anyone feel that a corner might have been turned at Newcastle? There's a man with a mic who will come over to you.
Hi, Scott from Newcastle. My worry is, we've got Norwich at the weekend. Chris Hughton's coming back. We've obviously come off two good results. I'm not sure if it's just, you know, like a flash pan thing, or, you know, Norwich will come and get a result there. That's my feeling.
That is the ultimate expression of pessimism. You're scared of Norwich. I mean, this can't be good. Okay.
That's a proper Newcastle fan, though, off the back of two big results. Yeah, yeah. That is your ultimate Newcastle fan. Norwich and West Brom to come.
Yeah.
Does anyone think that Newcastle will stuff Norwich? This is so sad.
Have you seen Norwich play this season?
They're all like Chris Hume because of the job he did, so they want Newcastle to win 1-0.
Sunderland had not won a single game of football. You know, they'd not won a game of football until Newcastle turned up. So,
Tom from Sunderland, I think they'll smash Norwich.
We're coming on to your lot later.
And whilst I'm facing you out there, and this is a bit mean and predictable, but is there anyone prepared to raise their hand to think that the appointment of Joe Kinnear is useful or makes any sense at all? Okay, that's fine.
Good.
For the benefit of our listeners, I think you should explain precisely how many people.
Okay, there were a total of.
Oh, hello, Mr. Kinnear.
Hi, my name's John from Durham. Just about the Joe Kinnear and the whole general thing, do you not think that Mike Ashley enjoys conflict? He enjoys conflict in the boardroom, and he wants conflict in the club, and he seems to get results through it. So although the fans get absolutely irritated by all this carry on, the net result seems to be fairly good results of minimal spend. I just wondered what the panel's opinion was of that. You know, how much of a driving force is he behind, you know, the current ethos of the club?
That's a very good point. There is a sort of perverse element to his nature, I think, which isn't always a negative, but there is a perversity to his approach to football. Ollie, Mike Ashley, what's he doing?
Well, I agree with that. There does seem to be a feeling sometimes that, well, looking from the outside, looking from further away than George and certainly further away than Steve, but it seems like he almost gets bored. It seems like, you know, everything's ticking along nicely, and you know, I mean, there seemed to be no logic to sacking Chris Hughton when he did.
No.
And there seemed to be no logic to hiring Joe Kinnear. And it almost seems like if he's not going to be getting his kicks from watching a team competing in the top four or in the Champions League or whatever, it seems like he almost seems
some
to
really
get
annoying
kicks.
People.
Well, perhaps. I don't know. I always have to come back to the fact he's a very good businessman. And I suppose if you look financially at Newcastle, they are now a stronger proposition than they were, albeit not when it comes to competing for players, seemingly. But it's really strange because I looking at it from the outside, I can't work out what Ashley is there for, what's really in it for him. Because it seems like, I mean, he has put money in. He's, you know, there are all these loans and so on, and it can't be much fun. So it seems almost that he seems to be getting his kicks from winding people up, or antagonising, or getting his mates in, and then falling out with people, and then moving them on. It's really weird.
I can't. I mean, in all seriousness, I can't sort of believe that there's any sense from him that he just enjoys winding people up. I mean, he does do it. I mean, he does it like regular as clockwork. You know, they talked about a director of football last season, and it was a conversation they had within the club. I know this directly through Alan Pardew. He was certainly okay with the idea. You know, we know what a good job Graham Carr does as chief scout. Alan obviously did a good job in the season they finished fifth. That relationship could be a bit smoother, I guess, in terms of who's identifying the players, how does it work, blah blah blah, and the idea is that someone comes in above. There's a bit more football strategy there. Derek Lambias wasn't a football man, Mike Ashley's not a football man, and so you can understand that logic, and it's something that plenty of clubs have done. Having said that, I think I think the idea was that they would put somebody in there with experience of doing it, who had a track record of doing it. That man is not Joe Kinnear.
And I just, before we leave this topic, I want to know, have you had dinner with Mike Ashley?
No.
Have you had a drink with Mike Ashley?
We had an end of season thing where he was buying everybody a drink. I think it was £3 for a pound. I think it was supposed to be £9.99, but you got £3 for a pound, I think. I always found he was very uncomfortable around people, you know, with his white shirt and his jeans and his hands in. And he was almost, you know, I'd read about him and heard he was this sort of, you know, recluse and, you know, mega successful businessman, but he almost seems uncomfortable around players. And I mean, to touch on your point, I mean, he can't, I've had hundreds of fans say, is he doing it on purpose? Is he just doing it to, you know, upset us and all that? And Joe Kinnear knows him and is his pal by all accounts. And when Derek chose to move on, it probably filled a gap. But you know, when they had Graham Carr bringing the players in and Alan's job, the gaffer's job, as he was, a little slip there. It's his job to get the best out of them. Now, Joe is supposedly responsible for bringing the players in. Where does that leave Graham Carr and Alan Pardew's job is still to get the best out of the players. And as I said, you know, hit the nail on the head over there. After a couple of good results, you think, if we get beat off Norwich and then we don't get anything over West Brom, we'll have a new manager and all that. And it's just the life of a Newcastle fan, really, isn't it?
But I think you can at least say about Joe Kinnear that he's probably an improvement as a director of football on Dennis Wise, isn't he? If nothing else, he might bring more gravitas, more sophistication.
Probably more popular as well, actually.
But there we go.
Thank you, gents. Right, let's move on to international football. I have a theory that it's perfectly legitimate, once you have qualified for a major tournament, to then play abysmally, lose matches, as long as you're in some clever way preparing for the big one. We're not going to win any prizes. England are not going to win any prizes for wowing at Wembley in November, when they should be thinking about the sunshine of Brazil. So, who on the panel, I'll start with Ollie, as he's chief football correspondent, is going to disagree with me and say that, does it matter? Can Roy do what he likes at this point?
Yeah, he can. He was right to experiment. Not necessarily the experiments that everybody would have chosen, but I'm not too hung up on the results. I mean, they lost the last two games. I don't think that necessarily matters all that much, but I just don't really see any kind of great source for optimism. And to be honest, I didn't see any great source for optimism when they were qualifying last month, beating Montenegro and Poland. I mean, they were two decent performances, but they were the same old flaws, or some of the same old flaws were apparent. I mean, I just don't think they look like you can trust them defensively, or certain games where they do get it right defensively, I don't think they look like they can attack with any fluency or imagination whatsoever. I don't think they ever have the right balance. And so if we're talking about those two results over the last few days, I don't think the results matter, but I think the fact is that you're looking for real positives from these games. And I think if you cite a few positives, I thought Joe Hart was better last night than he has been for a while. I thought Andros Townsend was good, but we're clutching at straws. I just don't think there is even the nucleus of a good team there.
So it doesn't matter what he experiments with, there isn't anybody he could bring in to change your pessimism?
I think he's been dealt a really poor hand as an England manager. I think he's come in at a time where what I consider to be a very, very good generation, which is the sort of Terry, Ferdinand, Cole, Beckham, Scholes, Gerrard, Lampard generation, that is, you know, they're really at the fag end of that generation. I think there's a group of players behind that who are of nothing like the same quality beyond Rooney. And then beyond that, you're looking at younger players. And we're getting incredible. There seems to be this sudden need to get very excited about players who look good on Match of the Day one week. And, you know, someone like Ross Barkley is a very good player, but you're getting people suddenly talking about him being a starter or being in the squad for England. And very good player, but he's yet to prove anything, really. I mean, it's not like... if I can ramble on for another minute, I mean, people keep talking about wild cards. Who could be England's wild card? I think we've already got sort of four or five wild cards in the squad who are people who have not yet really proved anything. I kept going back to 1986. England's wild card was Peter Beardsley, who'd basically been brilliant in the First Division. I think it was 36, 37 goals over two seasons for Newcastle in the First Division. 1990, the wild card was David Platt, who had just been Player of the Year in a very good Aston Villa team. And then we get to, you know, 2012, the wild card was Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, who barely played for Arsenal. And now we're talking about, you know, wild cards. Is it going to be Berahino? Is it going to be Barkley, Morrison? All these players who have barely kicked a ball in the Premier League. And it's just, that is indicative of a real lack of depth and real lack of quality across the board in English football.
That was a downer, wasn't it?
Yeah, sorry.
Steve, you're patriotic. You're I don't know what you are. You're something. You're better than that.
I think the experiment, you call it experimental by picking a few different players and young wildcards, whatever you call them, but they're still out there playing under the same pragmatic framework that England have, and the way they've qualified and the way they will play in the World Cup. I think a real experiment would have picked a younger, vibrant side and asked something different of them, because you mentioned a few players there, the likes of Barkley, who play a certain way for their club, then go into the England setup where by all accounts they do a lot of shape, they're restricted in what they're expected to do, they get behind the ball, and you're limiting what you're going to get from them players by not letting them express themselves in the way for the club. And when you've got two free hits basically of Chile and Germany at home, rather than putting, you know, more square pegs in square holes, do something different, play a different formation, go out and say, you know, you can say afterwards, oh, the result wasn't important because they played the same way. For me, a true experiment would have been to try five at the back, try 4-1-4-1, just try something different.
Say
to these young lads, not that, I wouldn't go that far, but say to these young lads, go out, you know, work on a few set pieces and say, go out, enjoy it. There's 90,000 people there. Go out. There's no pressure on you. It's not a qualifier. We've qualified. Go and enjoy yourselves. What if you get beat 3 or 4-0 and say, well, yeah, I tried something different. I gave them the freedom to play. It didn't work. And I think you would have got a lot more respect from people by saying, you know what, good on him, because he gave them the opportunity to go out and express themselves. It didn't work. And maybe, you know, if you're throwing them in saying sink or swim, maybe a few more might have swum.
Or what you do is you play your strongest team in the system you think England ought to play in the World Cup finals, but you substitute one maximum of two positions for a player who is like Adam Lallana, someone who you've got a soft spot for. If you're Roy Hodgson, he appears to have a soft spot for him.
I got him in the squad last week at Southampton. Did you not see that? I got him again. You had to mention him, didn't you?
And you let him have 90 minutes. And to me, that would be the best way to use these friendlies, George.
I don't think I've ever felt this untethered from England. There's a, you know, professional reason for that. I cover Ireland now, Republic of Ireland, and so I haven't seen any England games recently. Also, I think as Ollie was saying there, you know, there isn't much to get excited about. I mean, I am English, but I'm not kind of feeling a lot there. And the other side of it is, I've kind of experienced the England thing a little bit as a journalist, and pretty much hated the whole experience. That was a while ago, but there was this, and I think things have changed, but I'll just say this, that there was a institutionalized arrogance about the FA, about the players, about the media, most definitely, certainly would say that, and, you know, and also about the people that followed the team. Now, that was getting on for 10 years ago, so I think things have changed a bit. I'm delighted to see that the England team, when they get to Brazil, will be staying in Rio. So even if they're not very good, they'll have a good time and they'll find out what a tournament's all about. And I do mean that. I mean that absolutely sincerely. I think that's a great move that they're going to be in the middle of the city, and they'll actually experience what a tournament is like, as opposed to being in some 5-star prison camp in the middle of nowhere, which I think is disgraceful.
The problem with George is he always sits on the fence. Is there anybody who would like to say either who they think would be a good wild card or feel more optimistic than the panel appear to about England's prospects?
My name is Obi. I'm from Newcastle. my take on the international team, especially England, is that the problem they have is it's not about the individual players, because if you look at the other international teams, individually, not all the players are as good as England players. But the problem that England always have, and it's always continued, is obviously in this current team, is players don't actually fit into the system. There's no system that Hodgson is taking. He's not actually brave enough to find a system that works for all the players that he has. Because at the moment, all the players seem to be very good at direct football, which is quickness. That's what they play in the Premiership. But when they play in the international, they've been told to play a bit more defensive, pass the ball. Obviously, that's what Spain do. But they're not really, they don't do that most of the time in the Premiership. And they struggle when they play in the international games.
So you're saying that Roy should say, look, we're playing international football, we can't play the way we play week in, week out. We have to change it. When you come to England camp, you have to play a different type of football.
But if he's brave enough to find a system that works for the players, that England players that we have at the moment, find a system that works for them, then implement it. At the moment, if we start playing the way Spain or other teams play, we're kind of behind because they've already, they have a couple of years ahead of us in terms of mastering the system.
Sure, yeah.
We need to find a system that works, that'll probably work in future because at the moment we're behind. We need to be a bit more proactive, be a bit more advantageous in terms of finding a system that works, that'll be working in 5-10 years' time.
Ollie, we haven't got time to change the way we play.
No, and to be honest, I think Hodgson has tried. I think he's taken himself out of his comfort zone in trying at times a more expansive game. I think we see. I mean, there was that game in Kiev against Ukraine in September where, you know, England really grinded out a really turgid 0-0 draw, and I think Hodgson was quite happy with that. And I think he from what I can sense from him and speaking to him a lot, he feels that there is a need and an obligation really to try this more expansive approach. I don't think it particularly suits him, but I also think it leaves England sort of between two stools, and I don't think they can suddenly decide now let's change our style, because you look at it, he's only really got one game, which is two training sessions before he names his squad in the summer. I mean, the limitations of an England job mean that you can't really do a great deal. You've got to go with what you've got, and I think it'd be very difficult to do the type of thing that you're talking about. But at the moment, it feels to me like they're neither one thing nor the other.
Ollie, when England play Denmark in March, the last friendly we have, do you think, betting wise, odds wise, do you think John Terry will be playing in that game?
No chance. No.
Because?
Well, he retired from international football. I actually think, it's not a very popular view, or at least it wasn't before last Friday, I actually think he would improve England's defence if he was there, because I think he has qualities as a leader and as a sort of proactive ball-winning defender that other English defenders don't have. But I also think, I mean, the baggage that comes with him, he'll be 33 next month. He decided ultimately to turn his back on England.
But he'd love whatever the right rights or wrongs.
Well, he shouldn't have thrown his toys out the pram and retired when, to my mind, the FA had a good reason to go after him. It's you know, in an ideal world he would not have walked out. Well, you know, in an ideal world he would not have come across Anton Ferdinand that day. But it was no, John Terry. We spoke to Hodgson about this last night. His view was, you know, John Terry moved. You know, John Terry retired from international football at the start of this campaign. We move on, and I think even if Terry would improve the team, it's not going to be the difference between England winning the World Cup and not. Let's be honest.
Who would your first choice centre?
I have no idea.
Who would you pick?
It would be Jagielka and one other. And I went into this qualifying campaign thinking that Jagielka was a weak link, but I think he is. I think he's been the strongest of by some distance of the back four. I think Cahill is erratic. Perhaps good when he's got his back to the wall, but prone to errors in other games. I think Jones and Smalling have great potential, but they're just not playing in central defence for their clubs. And
even if John Terry stays in London and England go to Brazil and end up by some miracle winning it, he'd find some way of being on the pitch, wearing his shin pads and his shorts.
Yeah, the draw was made on December the 6th, and England could very easily be drawn against Newcastle. So, can we end, before we have our interval where you can have a beer and whatever, can we have a vote? Does anybody think England will get beyond the quarter-final stage in Brazil? That is a resounding. Oh no, we have what we have. We
people
have
actually,
one.
People actually folding their arms.
We have one arm in the air, sir. You wouldn't like to say why you're optimistic, would you?
Well, yeah. John Marshall. Having watched England win the World Cup in 1966 with a great deal more, perhaps, passion and belief than I'm hearing from the panel tonight, I say the World Cup is a bit like the FA Cup. And once you get out of that group, it becomes a knockout game of football. And you've got to go there and try and win, not do what we did against Portugal and the Europeans, where we scored a goal and then defended for 84 minutes. England don't do that well. Mm. It's not the way we play football. And I think what John Terry brings to the side that we could do with more of, he'll die for the cause. He'll put his head between someone's foot and the ball if it needs be. And not enough England players show that kind of...
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Passion. And if I think we've got some fun, I watch kids football every week, and I watch the local teams, and I really, really do think we've got some fabulous footballers. But you've got to empower them and give them self-belief and ask them to win a game of football, not to try not to lose, but to actually go and win. And I think that's when England's at its best. So that's why I go to Sunderland every week and keep believing they're going to win. It's incurable. But England need more of that, you know.
Pessimism, optimism. There we go.
But I love that comparison between the World Cup and the FA Cup. And you're from the North East. I mean,
well, we won that 2-1.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's the new England manager. Enjoy your 15-minute interval. Welcome back, everyone. What we established, I think, in section one was that Ollie Kay is cynical, George Culkin is cynical, Steve Harper is cynical, and I'm a ray of sunshine. We're going to move on to the exciting world of Sunderland. Before we do, it'd be nice to establish, you know, the split in the audience. How many people here are Sunderland supporters? There are 1, 2, 3, 4.
And his dad.
Five.
His dad will be back in a minute, yeah, so 5. And is everyone else a Newcastle fan? Is anyone who's not a Newcastle fan? Oh, can you shout out what you are?
Liverpool,
Everton, Arsenal, quite a cross section then.
Have we got any Peterborough United questions coming up?
Stacks.
I did play against them in pre-season though, so I didn't.
So, but even if you're not a Sunderland fan, they are quite obviously the most interesting club of the decade, if not the century. And it doesn't go away. You know, they have a new manager, but the squabbling continues. You know, Martin O'Neill feels he has to say, I didn't do anything wrong. It all went wrong with Paolo. Paolo has to say, I inherited an absolute mess. So let's try and unravel whose fault it all was. That has to go to George first.
I've had my phone off for an hour. They might have got another manager. there is no easy answer to that, unfortunately. In terms of those two personalities, I'm very much in favour of Martin O'Neill. I've got to know him quite well, particularly since he's left Sunderland, actually. And he's a thoroughly decent bloke. It was fairly obvious that things were not going well towards the end of his time at the club. There were a lot of reasons for that. I'm sure he has to take a lot of responsibility for it too. But again, we've been talking about dysfunctional relationships at Newcastle or whatever, and certainly there was a lot of that going on there. He didn't do due diligence on Sunderland. I've been speaking to him on and off about the whole Ireland situation, and sort of a month after the job became open, I sort of said, you know, how's it going? What's going on? I'm still at the prevarication stage, he said, and he's been at the prevarication stage the last 40 years, as far as I can work out. Very interesting. I was just having a chat with somebody in the audience, a lad called Mitch, who was saying when Di Canio arrived, oh, I was really excited. It was a breath of fresh air. It turns out he was just an idiot. And I think one of the things about Sunderland, certainly this is my perspective, is that quite often it's a football club that needs a lift. It needs a spark beneath it. Roy Keane did that brilliantly when he arrived. There are reasons for that, historical reasons. I'm sure there's political, economic reasons. You know, you can even look at it to that depth. But when that sort of touch paper was lit by Roy Keane those years ago, it had an absolutely brilliant effect, and it kind of rippled out through the city. And when the football team is doing well, you can feel it across the city, just like at Newcastle. There was that initial reaction when Di Canio came in, but it dissipated pretty quickly. You can't look upon that appointment as anything other than disastrous. Yes, he kept them up, but to lose his job 12 games into a 2.5-year contract, you know, the club was on the verge of civil war. It was falling apart. The dressing room was falling apart. I feel desperately sorry for Sunderland fans, having been told for a couple of months that Phil Bardsley was the Antichrist. Then Gus Poyet comes in and says he's spectacular and extraordinary. And, you know, there he is in the team doing very well. He's always been a 6-7 out of 10 fullback. He actually gives a damn about Sunderland, which you wouldn't think to have heard some of the stuff that's been said about him. And also his own behaviour was appalling, you know, don't get me wrong. But, you know, and here we are again at the start of another era for Sunderland. It's I almost can't bring myself to write yet another footballer saying it's a new era. We've all got smiles on our faces. The manager, which I've just had to do today, following up. You know, we've all got smiles on our faces. It's brilliant, because I was just doing that 6 months ago, and then I was doing it a year before that. You know, there needs to be some stability there. I'm sorry, I'm rabbiting on. They did something interesting in the summer. They tried to do things differently. There's been a paucity of ambition in the transfer market, as far as I'm concerned, at Sunderland. It's been too obvious. It's been too Premier League dominated. They try to do things differently. The success or failure of that is completely down to whether they've got the right people in the positions of responsibility, and there's no suggestion that they do.
But be honest, and I think you will be, when Di Canio arrived, was there any part of you that could tell it was going to be a disaster straight away?
Well, that first week when it was, you know, his personal beliefs were all over the front pages was a pretty good, you know, pretty good suggestion that things weren't going to be quiet, and that was handled spectacularly badly by the club. You know, you got two great results against Newcastle and against Everton, so that sort of clouded things a little bit. Personally, I found him and his views and this sort of very, very disciplinarian nature to be pretty repulsive.
Steve, if you're in the dressing room and someone has that kind of rant and treats players like they're children who ought to be at Borstal, what can it ever work, being that hard line?
Not nowadays, no. I think the big part of it now is man management. Having had 512 managers in 20 years at Newcastle, I certainly think, you know, you can talk tactics and this, that and the other, but with the hand you're dealt and the players you've got, it's about getting the best out of them. And once you start digging them out, certainly your captain as well, then that filters, and once that almost cancer sets into your dressing room, then ultimately the only way it's cut out is by a change of manager. A couple of things, it's actually nice to be talking about mayhem 12 miles down the road than on our own doorstep. And when they did appoint Di Canio, I actually thought, isn't it nice to have something different rather than just picking out of that goldfish bowl of he's had 3 or 4 goes, let's give him another try. And part of me thought, you know what, that might just work, and for Newcastle fans, barring one result, it certainly did. I only, you know, my current manager now at Hull, Steve Bruce, and you look at his record now at Sunderland, if he hadn't been a Newcastle fan, I think he might still have been there.
That's not true.
Well, I think his record stands up pretty well.
Yeah, no, I know.
Since then, they went the opposite way and went for a Sunderland fan. It didn't work out with Martin O'Neill. De Canio, certainly they tried. They gave him too much free rein to do too much too quickly, and that doesn't work. Sam Allardyce did that at Newcastle. He came in with a preconceived idea that the place was a bit of a mess, and brought in, you know, 512 staff and too many players, and I think too many of the old guard. He tried to do it too quickly, and too many of the old guard that had been there a while sort of reared up against it. And once you have that in your dressing room and that sets in, then I think you're fighting a losing battle. And when I saw that happening at Sunderland, I thought, you know, I can't see that working out as well. But
I would like to defend Sunderland, actually, on the whole Steve Bruce thing.
Go on then.
You know, that his, where he was from, became an issue in his last game in charge, when you know, when they lost to Hull, am I right? Wigan. And you know, they chanted uncomplimentary things about him. Sunderland fans showed great patience.
St. Geordie is uncomplimentary.
Well, they shouted it. No. I was there for the Newcastle game. They were shouting it there.
No, okay, but fine. But you know, I actually adore Steve Bruce, and I think he's a really good manager. And I'm sad it didn't work out with him. I think the rug was pulled from beneath him when he had to sell Darren Bennett, for one thing, and they, you know, they never quite recovered from there. But Sunderland fans, and indeed the club, showed Steve great patience. There was a great will for him to turn it around, and they gave him every chance to. I'm afraid that by the end that just couldn't or didn't happen, and it was only in those final couple of games when, you know, they were, you know, he'd lost the relationship with supporters, that the fact he was a Geordie and had a fondness for pies was used against him, but that was not, you know, that was not the reason why he didn't.
I better move on to Gus Poyet than having worked with Gus for a month at Brighton, where ultimately his ambition cost him the job there by, I think, pushing the button of the chairman too many times. I like Gus, and you know, after his first home game, I wished him well, and I think he'll do well there. You know, obviously new managers get a bounce, and he certainly had that with a couple of home games, but I think he'll change the way they try and play, and with the emphasis on keeping the ball. And from, you know, from the radio show I do up here, Sunderland fans said the way they played against Manchester City, the ball retention and the way they went about winning the game, there were certainly good shoots of recovery there, and as long as they finish below Newcastle and Hull, I don't mind them staying up.
Was the delay in appointing Poyet because of the fear of another moody foreigner, Holly?
Well, I think that
there's a similarity outward perception of De Canio and Poyet, isn't there?
It's almost like they had a checklist and they thought big name ex Premier League player, foreign, slightly tempestuous, temperamental, should we say. It's slightly weird. I don't know the people on the Sunderland board as I would imagine George does, but is there any feeling that perhaps they like a big name in a way that they probably shouldn't? I mean, it's one thing going for the manager who got Swindon promoted from League Two, and it's one thing going for the Uruguayan manager who did very well with Brighton, but it seems impossible that they would have gone for those names without them being big names who had been Premier League players. I know this sort of star-struck thing is quite common in football, but Sunderland, from what I know of the people there, have they fallen for it?
No, I don't think it's that. I mean, big players, yes, but certainly not big managers. And you know, I think, as I sort of touched on earlier about the sort of whole transfer market scenario, they'd, Ellis Shorter decided that this summer he was going to set up a new system. In fact, he talked to Martin O'Neill about that towards the end of the season before he got sacked, and he introduced him to Roberto De Fancy, the Keith Lemon lookalike director of football there. So that kind of change was already in the cards. Now nothing came of that, and obviously Martin left. But they wanted a first team coach or head coach, whatever he's called, head coach as opposed to a manager. And they have a system where they have a Italian director of football, an Italian chief scout, and they wanted to branch off in that sort of direction. The logic of appointing Paolo Di Canio didn't. I mean, no. I can understand what that, you know, young, ambitious coach with personality who'd done pretty well in the lower league. I think that was really the way they looked at it, and the same with Poyet, but obviously with a bit more of a track record. And part of the delay before announcing his appointment was certainly that what they didn't want to get was Paolo Light. Mm. And you know, certainly so far the signs seem to be pretty positive.
Do any of the four Sunderland fans in the audience want to say whether they feel comfortable with Gus Poyet, that they feel this is an appointment for the longish term that might work? There's two in the front row.
Quite possible that Poyet knows the Championship and Di Canio didn't, and that maybe Ellis Short thinks that if he does get relegated, which is quite likely, that Poyet does have a much better chance than Di Canio would, because, well, as I say, he knows it. And also, a point I've discussed quite a lot with people is that will Ellis Short spend a lot in January, or will it only be if he thinks we actually have a chance of staying in the league? And that if he thinks we're dead and buried, he'll just almost even sell players so that we can cope better in a Championship.
You're making me well up. That's quite sad. George, cheer him up. It's going to be a big cash.
That was Mitch, whose line I nicked earlier. Well, you know, they bought, what was it, 14 players in over the summer. Not all of them sort of expected to sort of get into the first team straight away, but certainly mixed. I mean, very mixed is probably the kindest way of putting that. So getting money to spend in January isn't necessarily, you know, necessarily the answer per se. There have been meetings, or there were supposed to be meetings during the international break, between Poyet and De Fancy and the club hierarchy to look at what they have. He's not had a chance to do that yet, Poyet, and decide how they can go, you know, how they can go forward. You know, they lost their kind of biggest saleable assets, or most of them, over the summer. You know, that's another thing. You know, to lose Mignolet, Cessignon, and for Rose to go back to Tottenham was a big blow. So will there be money to spend? I would imagine there would have to be, you know, there would have to be sales before, you know, for that to happen. Never ever underestimate the power of desperation, because I know for a fact that Martin O'Neill had been told by Ellis Short at one point that whatever happened last season, he would be staying on as manager. Now, I know that from one of those two people involved. It doesn't take a genius to work out which one it is. That didn't happen. When Ellis Short thought Sunderland were in danger of being relegated, he acted. So, you know, there's a balance to be struck. At the moment, they've got a chance, so you would think that there's more, you know, that there's more chance of them doing something.
Steve, have you ever had dinner with Ellis Short?
No, but I did. I wasn't too far away when Alan Pardew walked past him and got a very rude response from him when he tried to say hello to him in the tunnel at the Stadium of Light.
Tell us more.
I think it's pretty much common knowledge. but no, I mean, as George said, you know, there are signs of recovery there under Gus, and I think he's trying to change the whole ethos and style of football there. And if you were ultimately relegated, would he then do the same in the Championship, having tried that with Brighton? He would have got Brighton out of the Championship if he'd got the extra couple of players that he was after and ultimately kept banging on the door for. And as I said, sadly, that did cost him his job at Brighton. But while I was there, you know, in the dressing room, they had the TV on, and whenever there was a job coming up, he was saying, "Should I go? I think I should go for that. I should go for that." So he always had his eye He always had his eye on bigger and better things.
So Sunderland might have a new manager now.
So they might, depends what's come up. So he always wanted a bigger and better job, and he's got the opportunity now in the Premier League.
Right, well, hands up, I thought when Hull were promoted, they were no hopers. I mean, they couldn't score in the Championship. I'm not quite sure still how they were promoted. They seem to me the most likely team to struggle. Instead, there's this incredible air of realism and organisation at the club, and they're doing rather well. And I think probably it's fair to go to the man who plays there to tell us why it's going so well.
Well, pretty, apart from the last game when we got battered at
Southampton,
we've been very solid, and we've had six brutal away fixtures: Chelsea, Man United, Everton, Tottenham, Arsenal, and then Newcastle and Southampton, and we've competed in every single one of them, barring 45 minutes at Southampton and the first half an hour at Chelsea. We've played very, very well and been unlucky to lose five of those six games. And at home, he says, sounding like a Newcastle fan, with Crystal Palace at home on Saturday.
What can possibly go wrong?
You know, it's Saturday is a big game for us, because if we hopefully go on and beat Crystal Palace with 17 points from 12 games, we're in a good place, because the week after that we've got 9 days of Liverpool at home, Arsenal away, and Swansea away. So all of a sudden, Crystal Palace at home becomes a big game, and if we win that, we'll be going well. But if we get injuries in key players, somebody mentioned earlier, Huddleston, Livermore in the middle, are probably two players we can't afford to lose. So far so good, and come 5 o'clock on Saturday night, hopefully we'll be sitting pretty solidly tucked in the middle of the table. But I've been very impressed with Steve. You know, from I'm not just saying that because he might be listening. But I heard all this, you know, negativity from Sunderland, tactically this, that, and the other. And I've been there for 11 games, and we've played three different formations. So you know, nobody can say he's a one-trick pony or he's limited and this, that, and the other.
He has a very different public persona from what he's like with players.
I don't think he gets enough credit for. Yeah, he played 3-5-2 last year, and you know, very good defensively, and won 1-0 a lot, but it worked. And to get Hull out of the Championship into the Premier League is no mean feat, and I don't think he's got the credit he deserves for that. But a bigger achievement would be keeping us in the Premier League, and hopefully, like I said, on 5 o'clock on Saturday night, we'll be well on the way to doing that.
I really like a manager who thinks it's his job to look at the opposition and work out a way to beat the opposition, instead of a manager who thinks, I have a way of playing. If we end up losing because we're going to Stamford Bridge or Old Trafford, so be it, because I'm going to stick to my plan. Ollie, do you admire Steve Bruce's pragmatism?
Yeah, I do. I've always been impressed by Bruce as a manager. And if we're talking about his time at Sunderland, I think, as George sort of implied, that there's a situation at Sunderland where people seem to, you know, the team seems to go stale very easily under new managers. There always seems to be a bounce, but and we see it get smaller and smaller, so perhaps the Poyet bounce is already over, I don't know. But the I thought, apart from those perhaps final 6-12 months at Sunderland, I think Steve Bruce has shown himself to be a fairly shrewd manager, and he's always bought well as well.
Is that what happens, Stephen? Is he just assiduously going through the weaknesses of the opposition, and he has no ego about my team's only play this way, we're going to fiddle around, because I think the best way to beat Team X is to identify that weakness and change our tactics accordingly. Is that what you mean by?
Well, the biggest example would be, we played Tottenham away twice in 4 days recently. I played in the league game on the Sunday where we set up as a five, knowing what was going on with the crowd, to frustrate them, you know, limit them to long range shots and try and catch them on the counter attack, which we did, and arguably in the first half had better chances than them, but for a dodgy penalty, don't get me started on that. We lost the game 1-0. We deserved a point from that game. He changed a lot of the personnel in the week, did the same for the first half an hour, and we couldn't get the ball, and it was Sigurdsson scored an unbelievable goal, 1-0 down. And rather than wait till half time or stick to his guns, he changed it and he went 4-4-2. And as soon as he changed it, we started getting on the ball. At half time, he came in and he said, right, rather than sitting back, it's a cup tie, let's have a go and see how good they are. Yes, if we sit off and let them, they can keep it and they can play. I'm not so sure that they're as good as people give them credit for with the ball. So let's go and have a right go at them, 4-4-2. And we did that. And we were unlucky. It was 2-2. We lost on penalties. And we caused them a lot of problems. And at half time, I'm sitting there, you know, 20 years at Newcastle, the pessimist, thinking, I'll just keep it the same and hang on, we might nick one late on. And he came in and, you know, don't go 4-4-2, we might get battered five from a goalie thinking we might get beat 5 or 6. And he went, right, it's a cup tie, let's have a right go. And afterwards I thought, you know what a great call that was. And, you know, that's my best way of saying I saw both sides of him. And rather than being this one up front guy, he was at Sunderland, by all accounts, he sold Jan and Bent, so he only had one player to play up front as well. So I've seen a lot of him in the dozen or so games that I've been there, and I've been very impressed.
So come the end of the season, are we thinking Newcastle finish higher than Hull, who finish higher than Sunderland? Does anyone in the audience think that isn't how it's going to end up?
Good lad.
Is this Mickey? Mitch.
Hi, I'm Mitch. I think that it'll be probably Newcastle highest, then Sunderland, then Hull. But I think all three might stay up, maybe. We'll see.
It's a long way down through that window, you know.
Okay, let's put it another way. Does anyone in the room feel that all those three clubs will escape relegation?
Newcastle 4, Arsenal 4 match.
Yeah.
What was the elbow drop all about?
Well, that, if ever there was, I mean, talk about pessimism and optimism wrapped up in one game. To be 4-0 down after 26 minutes in front of the Gallagher end is not really a good place to be. Especially when, you know, we're up the hill, 4-0 down, and I'm thinking I'm going to be the first goalie to let 10 goals in the Premier League. So I'm pretty slow at goal kicks at the best of times, but now I'm stalling for half time. And one guy in the Gallagher end shouted, "Hurry up!" And I'm thinking, we're 4-0 down against the Red Arrows. It's half an hour gone. We just need to hang on for half time. Now at half time, I went in and I basically said, if any of you put the white flags up, I'm going to be the first one to let double figures in it. And with Alan Pardew, he came in and made a good speech. A classic piece of advice from the goalkeeping coach as we came off the second half was, you haven't got your fingerprints on any of the goals, let's just keep it that way. Basically, none of them are your fault. Whatever happens, make sure none of the rest of them are your fault as well. And even when we scored, you know, Joey did what Joey does well, and, you know, got the crowd going, got us back in the game. Even when we scored to go to 4-1, having been at Newcastle for so long, I thought, oh no, the crowd are going to think we're going to get something now. And it's going to be 7 or 8-1 but then it's 4-2 and then it's 4-3 and four. What happened at 4-4 was, and I ran over, obviously Czech ran all the way up, I ran over and in a split second thought, I'm a big lad, if I jump on these, I'm going to hurt somebody. So why I did an elbow drop, I don't know. But I actually elbowed Leon Best in the hamstring and he went into spasm and had to go off. So if I hadn't done that, we may well have won the game 5-4. So where it came from, I don't know. There's a bit of WWE from the past. And talk about the both extremes of being not just a footballer, but a footballer at Newcastle United. I came in after that game and just sat down and thought, what on earth has just happened? Because, you know, it's an emotional rollercoaster being a footballer anyway, but certainly in Newcastle, and for it to be wrapped up in 90 minutes and an elbow drop, that was yeah, that's as well as I can explain it anyway.
Well, the curious career of Steve Harper. Any other while he's here, ask about another classic match. Is anyone else who wants to pick his brains?
Hi, Sean.
after your testimonial, I was just wondering, do you practice your penalties?
Well, my son scored his at half time. I don't know if you saw that
just
as well. I think being a goalkeeper, you always want to take a penalty, and I'd had it in my head for all the years. If I got a penalty, I was going to smash it as hard as I could. And when I walked up and the goalkeeper made it pretty clear that he wasn't going to move, that didn't register in my head. I was always going to smash my penalty in front of 50,000 people, which I proceeded to do, and he still even tried to move out of the way and it still hit him. And I was too ashamed to take the offer of a retake from Mark Clattenburg and walk back with my tail very much between my legs, yeah. But I'd always wanted to take one. And yeah, it was. I mean, the whole point of the night was to, you know, charity match as it was. Everybody had said everything we tried to do and tap into and remind a few people at the football club of what it's all about and how you can engage the public and get them on side and buy into what you're trying to do. And it couldn't have worked any better.
Definitely, it showed from the amount of people that turned up and the AC Milan team that turned up how big an occasion it was.
Yeah, no, it was, well, thank you as well for coming, because ultimately, you know, it was your hard-earned money that it was a privilege to give away, knowing it was going to fantastic local causes as well.
So, remind us how much it was.
It was 327,800 and something, which we gave away to five very good local charities. So even today I drove past the From town, I drove past the Great North Children's Hospital, and it made me sit a little bit taller knowing that we'd given them six figures of money, knowing it was going to good causes. And it was a no-brainer, you know. I haven't had such a good relationship with the fans here to put something back. So it was a pleasure, and the whole night worked.
And I'll just embarrass Steve a little bit further at this point, but it's a measure of the man that he did that whole night, obviously, in a much smaller way. He's asked not to take a fee for tonight, and wants it a donation to go to the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation. So thank you for that as well, Steve.
It would be remiss of us not to mention Middlesbrough. Is Viva Mukherjee in the audience? He has a question about Middlesbrough.
Hi, what do the panel think about Middlesbrough's appointment of Ida Karanka and the new strategy that Steve Gibson's adopting, forging links with Peter Kenyon and super agent Jorge Mendes to get youth players from Europe, the young players from Europe, like to get up, you know, from the Championship?
Thank you, Ollie.
Well, the sort of links between players and between clubs and agents always concern me greatly. I think those kind of things very rarely work well. I mean, if you were going to align yourself to any one agent, you'd probably want it to be Jorge Mendes, because he's got wonderful players, like, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo is one of his, and he's obviously Ronaldo's not going to end up in Middlesbrough, but perhaps not this season. But you know, he's got an enormous stable of players. But you might end up with Bebe rather than with the next Ronaldo. So it's I mean, Karanka is an extremely interesting appointment. I mean, to be Mourinho's appointment. I mean, Mourinho's assistant, obviously Steve Clark wasn't he? He's turned out to be a very good manager. But you just don't know. I mean, he might have been Mourinho's assistant because Mourinho just liked him or trusted him or felt that he was going to be a bit of a yes man. You never know when somebody gets a job on the basis of what kind of assistant manager they've been in the past. But I would say of Middlesbrough, and I would say, you know, I would say of a lot of clubs currently, but particularly Middlesbrough, I think, having been there relatively recently, it's one of these clubs that is extremely depressed at the moment, or has been extremely depressed in recent times, and it just seems like it needs to be energised in a way that we talked about Sunderland needing to be energised. And I mean, Tony Mowbray in theory should have worked, others should have worked in theory, but they don't. And it's I think they need to try something different. They need to have a longer term strategy. They need to try to be more sophisticated, more clever in some ways, because if not, you know, a sort of large town club like Middlesbrough is in danger of becoming completely marginalised in English football, because it seems to be that those type of clubs are having been relegated, you know, they sort of fall to the margins, and Middlesbrough need to try something different, and let's see how it goes.
Yeah, it's very interesting what they're doing. We've talked about Sunderland and how they're doing things in terms of recruitment and what they're doing with their head coach and stuff like that. I actually had a chat with Steve Gibson today, thinking this might come up, and you know, if I could choose a chairman for any football club, I would choose Steve Gibson. He's gone down the obvious routes. He's gone for the, you know, Gareth Southgate, the ex-player who was at the club. He's gone for the local hero. He's gone for Gordon Strachan. I don't know why that's not a category in itself. I don't know why I said that. He's gone for the Gordon Strachan, and he's done all that sort of stuff. And this is now, you know, the parachute money is not there. And I absolutely know what you mean, Ollie, about it being sort of a depressed. And you know, I've been there this season, and it wasn't much fun. It's not much fun seeing that stadium empty. But they've got that wonderful, for a club of Middlesbrough's resource, to have that stadium, to have an absolutely incredible training ground with an amazing hotel attached to it, which is built by Gibson's sort of baby, and to have the wonderful academy, which is headed by Dave Parnaby. You know, they've got a lot going for them as a Championship football club. They've got facilities to rival anybody, really, in whatever division. What they've done, they've gone, you know, I don't know a lot about Karanka as a coach. I don't know what he'll do. That's not the only thing they've done. They've announced a tie-up so far with Atletico Madrid for a kind of swap of players. The idea eventually will be that, you know, promising young players will come from Spain to Middlesbrough, will be showcased, they'll get experience. It's a shop window for Atletico. It's also a chance to give them experience. Players could go the other way. They could learn something. I know that they're looking at similar arrangements in Italy, possibly elsewhere. There's no saying that it's going to work, but equally, you know, I think spot on. I think they had to do something different, and they've gone for it, and they've gone for it in a big way.
Steve, have you had your dinner with Karanka?
No, I just think, why not? I think they've both touched on that. You know, when you mentioned big crowd, big ground, small crowds, budget, no parachute payments. What they have been trying to do hasn't worked, and it's certainly cheaper to loan players and have a tie up with a foreign club than splashing out transfer fees like they have done, trying to buy your way out of the league. And why not think outside the box and try something different?
It's interesting you said they won't sign Ronaldo, and of course they won't, but I mean, they, not too long ago, they signed Janinho, which was an extraordinary. I mean, in that time, you know, it wasn't that long
Ravinelli.
Ago. And Ravinelli, and yeah, but I mean, Janinho was the, I'm trying to think what he was, South American player of the year that year or whatever. You know, and I mean, the good news is that Gibson is every bit as committed as he always has been, and fingers crossed they get it right. I think they've left it too late for this season.
But there's also a thing where these link-ups with clubs, I mean, I can understand the appeal to Middlesbrough of linking up with Atletico Madrid, but I look at the sort of Watford-Udinese situation, which it sounds great, but I just feel like there's this sort of identity thing that is in danger of disappearing. And I look at Middlesbrough a decade ago, they had a lot of, or even 5-6 years ago under McLaren, they had a lot of local players in the team.
That won't change.
You sure?
Yeah, no. That won't change. That anybody coming into the club has to have a commitment to the academy. And the one exception to that was Strachan, and that was that was disastrous.
There's a question in the second row.
I'm Niall. Me and my dad are Borough fans, and I was listening to what George was saying about Anatol Karanka and the tie-ups with Atletico Madrid, and I couldn't help but just let out a big sigh, because frankly, I think obviously Gibson's got an appetite for big names, but like Janino and Ravinelli are proof of that. But don't you think they've taken it a bit too far?
Firstly, I have that effect on a lot of people, don't worry. Great question. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, they've tried to go down the domestic route. They've tried to go down, you know, I think you can sort of see the thinking with each appointment. Southgate was the continuity candidate, the captain who had the club in his heart. Strachan was the guy who was going to come down from Scotland, toughen them up, bring in Scottish players from the divisions who would be on less money, who wanted something to prove. You could see the thinking. You can certainly see the thinking with Tony Mowbray, you know, that reconnection with the club's past. He would argue, Gibson would argue, that they're still a well-resourced club for the Championship. I mean, I think I don't want to kind of quote figures because I'll get it wrong, but, you know, I think he would say something like top six in the Championship still in terms of resource. It hasn't worked. You know, nobody wanted Tony Mowbray to work more than Steve Gibson did, and, you know, arguably they could have done some, they could and should have done something in the summer, and that would have allowed them to move on sooner. I mean, one thing I would say is that the time of Ravinelli and Janino and Emerson and all those players that we remember was an incredibly exciting time to be a Middlesbrough fan, and certainly to report on Middlesbrough. It was fantastic. It was the most successful spell in their history once you tag the Steve McLaren era onto the end of it, and they're just looking for something different. You know, they're looking for a new way of doing things. One thing I know about Steve Gibson is he won't have done it lightly, and once he is committed to something, it will be all in.
Does that satisfy you, that answer?
I get that a lot as well. Just
Thanks for listening. Thank you to the excellent panel, Ollie, George, and of course Steve. I don't think I've met a more eloquent footballer. Thank you to you, the live audience, for your contributions, and we do this again.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In February in Manchester. Goodbye.